Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. A warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. What a clever name. It describes the part of the day and has my name in it. There you go. We're glad you joined me today because we have, once again, I hate to say it, but I repeat myself, we've got a fantastic lineup. Shanti Feldhahn is going to be with us in just a minute, and we're excited to talk to her because of her new book, which I find absolutely fascinating. It's called The Kindness Challenge. All right. Now, when I go to in Galatians 5, you talk about the fruits of the Spirit. Let's review. We've got love, we've got joy, we've got peace, we've got long-suffering, and the next one, kindness. And then we'll go to goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. But talk about kindness. Wouldn't we all like to be more kind? And I wonder if we think, if we give ourselves a lot of credit for being kind. If you ask, are you a kind person? You go, yeah, I'm pretty kind. I'm pretty good. I'm pretty kind. But then are you really, throughout your day, your thoughts, your actions, the way you treat people or not treat people, does that say kindness? We're going to talk to Shanti about that in just a minute. Then Amy Simpson is going to be with us also in this hour. And I've had Amy on the show in the past, and she is an author and a speaker. And we're going to talk about troubled minds, mental illness, and the church's mission. Mental illness is kind of one of those things we don't like to talk about. Just too uncomfortable, and there's stigmas around it, and maybe the church could do more, and how do we effectively minister to those who are affected with mental illness? So that's all ahead in hour one. Thank you for joining me today. It's 6 minutes after the hour. We will, after a very short break, be back with Shanti.
Maybe you've experienced this. When you give a gift, seeing the response to the person receiving the gift and the joy it brings them is better than giving the gift itself. I'm Neil Stavem, Program Director for Faith Radio, and on behalf of our entire team and ministry, we say thanks to all of you who have given so generously this past year. Our hearts are full of joy and gratitude for you, and even though we may not meet face-to-face to say thanks in person, know that we're honored that you stand with Faith Radio prayerfully and financially. You made it possible for significant ministry to take place, with more people listening, new signals added to our network, and new programs bringing stories of life change, like Repurposed with Jared Sebesta and The Jeremiah Johnston Show, addressing the hard questions about our faith and the hope we have in Christ. And all of this is a result of your partnership. So in the season of giving, we again say thanks for your gifts to Faith Radio. You can join us at myfaithradio.com.
Welcome back. It's 7 minutes after the hour. Awfully glad you joined me today because you're going to like this next discussion I'm going to have with Shanti Feldhahn. She is, I thought I might have something in common with her until I started reading her credits, and she got her graduate degree from Harvard. Okay, way too smart for me. And then went to Wall Street and then started doing some social research, and she became a best-selling author and a very, very popular speaker. Her latest book, The Kindness Challenge, 30 Days to Improve Any Relationship, is something we all need to learn more about. Shanti, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you so much. I love the way you think. I love that we're taking one of the fruits of the Spirit and making a big deal out of it.
Yeah, me too.
Because, we live in a world that is so uncivil. Everybody is just at each other's throats.
Everybody's so friendly and sweet today.
All right. You're messing with me, aren't you, right now? Yeah. You're using some kind of reverse psychology.
Yeah. It's so funny because this is one of those areas that, you're probably a nicer person than me. But
there's no way.
This is one of those areas where I constantly find myself just so frustrated by how unkind our culture is, right? Like you see people yelling at each other on the news and, on social media. And the thing that just boggled my mind when I started this particular research project is realizing, oh my gosh, it's not just them, it's me. We think we're all, like everybody listening to this is like, but I already am kind. And we don't know that we're deluded. We're really not. At least not what we think we are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's two sides of the coin. So I'm trying to be kind. So I hold the door yesterday at the post office, and the person walks through and doesn't acknowledge me in any way. And it's like I went from feeling kind to going, what am I, the doorman?
Yeah, exactly. Well, here's one of the things that we ended up finding in all seriousness as we started doing kind of, you know, we do all these surveys, right? That's what we do. We're social researchers. And so we were trying to figure out, you know, what really are the things that matter, that make the difference to improve relationships? And, you know, what are the different actions that change our hearts and that will end up changing the culture in the end? And honestly, we found that so many of us who so pride ourselves on being kind people, we have no idea that we'll hold the door open at the post office and then we'll roll our eyes at our kids. Like, what? Like, I'm kind to everybody else except for the people that I care about the most.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So the people who are in our intimate circle were not that kind towards.
Well, we certainly don't realize that there are things that we can do that will, that really are actually hurting us and hurting our relationships. And so conversely, we don't realize that if we want to improve any relationship, and seriously, I mean any, we found statistically literally any relationship, like your marriage, your kids, your colleagues, your mother-in-law, like that neighbor that drives you nuts, you can literally improve any relationship by doing a few simple things that we call, well, we call it the 30-day kindness challenge.
Yeah.
That's just the name we gave it, but literally so simple.
Yeah. And I want to talk about how simple that is, but would the words intentional kindness be something we should have in our heads?
Yeah, you know, we think of, everybody thinks of the random acts of kindness movement. Like, I can guarantee that when we started talking about this, that's where people's brains went.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about being kind and doing acts of service and, you know, paying for the people in the beat-up car behind you at the drive-thru.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's kind of... Or like holding the door for the person at the post office.
Yeah.
That's where our brains go. And
yeah.
and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it, the random acts of kindness, but that doesn't, it turns out that doesn't actually change anything. It may make their life better for a moment, but it doesn't change you. And what we found is that if you will do intentional, targeted types of kindness for one person, it not only really kind of impacts that person, what it really does is it opens your eyes to all these things you didn't realize that you were doing that was hurting them and you, and it ends up really changing you.
Mm-hmm.
And then that really changes the relationship and changes you and all your relationships for the better.
All right, Shanti, I got to ask you this. Why is venting about somebody just not helpful? Doesn't that help let off some steam? Isn't that good?
Well, you know what? We all believe that. we've all bought into that. And me too, right? Like, I had always thought that there's this, you know, idea of if you're getting upset, it's better to little steam out of the kettle, you know, so the pot doesn't explode, kind of. And it turns out, no, actually, that is completely inaccurate neurologically. What happens as you're, quote unquote, venting, as you're getting a little stuff off your chest, I'm so irritated with my husband, would you not believe what my daughter did again, you know, that kind of stuff. What happens is the neuroscientists have tracked this in the brain, and they've found that it actually activates this interconnected anger system in the brain.
Oh,
so
great.
The better word picture, I know, the better word picture isn't what, yeah, I know. Well, here's the good news. Okay, so the better word picture isn't venting the steam out of the kettle. The better word picture is that when you're complaining or you're venting, you're actually, it's more like turning the heat up under the pot.
Okay.
And so it's boiling more. And now here's the good news, though, is that when you refuse to do that, like you're tempted to complain about your husband to your coworkers, and you just don't. And you actually look for some good things instead, which I know we need to talk about in the 30-day kindness challenge in a second, but that's one of the elements, is like to look for the good stuff instead. And you do that, it's almost like what you've done is you've turned the heat off and you've taken the pot off the burner and you've put the lid on it. And your steam, so to speak, it just kind of goes away. Like you're not as angry. Because think about it for just a second. If you're irritated with someone and you tell them they're irritated and you tell somebody else that you're irritated, are you going to be more or less irritated?
I know the standard answer would say you're going to be less irritated because you've shared your feelings. But I think your answer is you're going to be more irritated.
You're going to be more irritated. All you're doing is reinforcing it. And what the neuroscientists have found is that if, and it's not necessarily natural, you have to actually tell yourself to do it. But if you actually refuse to share that irritation, even if it's just for a time, like you do it for a few days, you do it for a week or something, and you refuse to do that, instead you're looking for the positive, it turns out you're going to be less irritated.
Well, what about when somebody says, well, you're not sharing your real feelings with me. Now I'm irritated with you.
Yeah, really. Well, here's the thing, actually, that we found. We actually had about 1,000 people in the study group that were studying as we were trying to figure out what we eventually called the 30-Day Kindness Challenge, but just essentially what is it that you can do that changes things in you and in others?
Mm-hmm.
And what we actually found in the middle of that, honestly, is that we're often complaining for the pleasure of complaining.
Interesting. Shawnee, let me take a little break. When I come back, we got to hear what the challenge is. What are the simple 3 steps that you can start doing effective today? Shawnee Feldhahn has written a book called The Kindness Challenge, 30 Days to Improve Any Relationship. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. It's 18 minutes after the hour. Shawnee Feldhahn is my guest. She's written a book called The Kindness Challenge, 30 Days to Improve Any Relationship. Shawnee, let's start with the name, because is that your full name you were given at birth, Shawnee?
I was. Believe it or not, it actually means peace in Hindi.
Oh, nice.
My parents were in the Peace Corps in India before I was born.
Oh, that's very cool. And then is Feldhahn your married name, or is that your...
My married name. Yep.
What was...
Good German name.
What was it before?
Another good German name, Leidinger.
Shawnee Leidinger. Yeah, I like that.
Exactly.
I like that. All right, let's get down to the kindness challenge. What are some 3 steps that we can take effective right now?
So here's what we found makes a huge difference, is you pick somebody that you want a better relationship with. Like, it could be your spouse, or it could be your child, like I did this for my teenage daughter. or, like I said, your mother-in-law.
Uh-huh.
You know, it could be any relationship. And you do 3 things for 30 days. The first is you say nothing negative about that person.
That's
either
not gonna
to
work.
Them or about them. Yes, that's exactly what so many people think. I mean, you should see this. I do a lot of women's conferences. And whenever I tell the women, okay, we're going to improve our marriages, for example, don't say anything negative about your husband for the next 30 days. And you hear this, to the whole audience. But here's what happens. We don't realize that step, that's actually often where we sabotage our relationships. Because if I'm in a difficult season with my husband, I can be, you know, polite to him. But if I'm going to my girlfriends at work and I'm saying, oh, you would not believe what he did, I don't realize it, but I am sabotaging how I feel about him. And by the way, I am training myself to be an unkind person. Like, I don't think of it that way, but that's exactly what I'm doing.
You're unlearning something, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely. Let me tell anybody who wants to do the 30-Day Kindness Challenge, you're going to spend the first 2 days, maybe the first 3 days, going, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, I had no idea. that I was so unkind, that I was so negative. You just don't realize how often you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so that's the first thing, is say nothing negative, either to them or about that person. Second thing is to find one thing you can sincerely praise, that you can sincerely affirm about the person. And you tell them, and you tell somebody else. So like, you know, I can't complain to my girlfriends about this thing my husband did, but I'm looking for things to praise. And so, like, for example, I might say, you know, I noticed he came home from work early to take the kids to their activities. And so I tell him, thank you for doing that. And then I go to my girlfriends at work the next day and I say, you know what he did yesterday? He came home from work early to take the kids. And I don't realize it, but what I'm doing is basically just putting Philippians 4:8 into action. Like, think on whatever is excellent and lovely and worthy of praise, you know, rather mm-hmm. than what's worthy of driving you crazy. So those are the first two things.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is every day for 30 days, find one thing that you can do that is an action of generosity or some way of being generous to them, some action of kindness, do some small action of kindness. And this, by the way, this doesn't have to be just like you think of an act of service, you know, like you bring somebody coffee. Like,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have to be something like that. Literally, what I found as an action of generosity that mattered to my daughter when I was doing this for her was she'll come in when I'm on my computer working on a deadline, and she'll say, hey, Mom, can you watch this cute little YouTube video with me? And I'll be like, in an hour, honey. But if I take my attention off of what I'm doing and put it on her, it's just a 5-minute video, but that's actually an action of generosity. And you don't think of these things, but being purposeful about doing those three things every day for 30 days, we found that 89% of relationships improved. 89%. That is huge.
Shanti, but I'm trying to get back to your action steps. I love the saying nothing negative, and then look for one positive thing.
Say the positive.
Yeah. What happens when you start doing that and you're starting to raise suspicions like, oh, what do you want from me?
You know what? Some people are actually a little bit like, what? Especially if the relationship has been strained before. But if you're being sincere, and that's the key. It can't be fake. Like, really, you have to pick the right person to do this for. It does have to be somebody who's fairly close to you. You know, the spouse, the child, the in-law, you know, a colleague you see every day that mm-hmm. you wish you had a better relationship with. But if you're being sincere, most of the time, we found statistically, most of the time people didn't even know that you were doing it. Because we say, don't tell them. I mean, if you want to do this together as a couple, yeah, fine, that works too. But most of the time we say, don't tell them, and just do it. And you'll find that really, because what's happening, and this is a subtle point, but it's really everything.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening is you're actually not just changing the temperature of the relationship, you're changing you.
What about if you know, so we're talking about words and actions. So words are important,
yes.
Actions are important. And if we're trying to look for a small act of generosity, and we're talking about, you know, time and focus, that's a resource that can be treated as something generous. Do I have that right?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Different people will find different things come naturally when it comes to being generous. Yep.
Will a person find it difficult to go, oh, I got to think of something to do or something positive to say?
You know what? We found actually people think it's going to be difficult, and then it's actually the hardest part is withholding the negative comments.
Yeah.
Is withholding the negativity. We all have different patterns of negativity. We don't think that's going to be the problem. And for everybody, that's the biggest issue.
Mm-hmm. So I think you suggest that kindness is kind of like a superpower, huh? I mean, I think it's, you know, it's like, do you want to be able to fly or see through walls? No, I'd really like to be able to be really nice all the time.
Well, here's what we found about when we say superpower. Obviously, tongue in cheek, I like superhero movies.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm the only one. Okay, I do. But tongue is, it's sort of a tongue in cheek, but there's some really, really profound truth underneath it, because what we found is that the impact of kindness True, Christ-like kindness, the impact of kindness is really, honestly, supernatural. It's miraculous. Like, literally, it changes your feelings. It melts through the walls that people put up. We say it makes you bulletproof to things that would have hurt you before. Like, and let me just, do you mind if I just give you an example?
Please.
Everybody's been in a situation. You're driving down the highway, lanes are merging, you're waiting in line, you know, along with everybody else in line, and then there's always that car that speeds down the edge
mm-hmm.
and tries to poke in at the very end, and I don't know about you, but my head wants to explode. Like, this is where I'm, like, pulling up on the bumper of the car, and I'm like, no, you are not.
You wait your turn, loser.
Well, essentially, what's happening is that person is being unkind, right? They're sort of firing bullets, so to speak, firing emotional bullets, and they're hitting. Like, it's making me crazy,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
What happens? Now, imagine, apply kindness to this. Imagine that they try to pull in front of you, and instead of pulling up on the bumper, you back off. You decide to be kind. It's completely unwarranted. They don't deserve it. But you back off. You wave them in. You smile. What just happened to your feelings? All of that agitation and that, no, you don't, you know, all those feelings just lifted off your shoulders. They're still firing bullets, but they're bouncing off.
Mm-hmm.
Because kindness has that power. It's made you bulletproof. It's astounding how supernatural, real, true kindness is.
Mm-hmm. So when you're kind in life, you will feel, and especially in relationships, you'll feel more loved and appreciated.
That's what we found statistically, is among the people who did the 30-day kindness challenge, like I said, 89% of relationships improved. The thing that blew me away, the thing that really blew my mind, is that 66% of the people who were doing it, remember, they're doing all the work. You know, if I'm doing this, I'm doing all the work. 66% of those people said at the end of the 30 days, they felt more loved and they felt more appreciated. They're the ones who are doing, quote unquote, doing all the work. And yet at the end, they truly felt more loved and appreciated in their, you know, for example, their romantic relationship.
Mm.
And that, again, that's just the paradoxical power of doing this purposeful effort to have loving kindness in our lives.
Yeah. Well, I know you've got everyone's attention, Shanti, because this is, I don't think anyone listening doesn't want to be more kind. Shanti's book is The Kindness Challenge, 30 Days to Improve Any Relationship. You're just a lot of fun, Shanti. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
And thanks for being so kind to me.
No, thank you. Your kindness is having me on. So
there you go. Have a great day. Thank you so much for doing the show.
You too. Take yep. care. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Again, Shanti Feldhahn's book, The Kindness Challenge, 30 Days to Improve Any Relationship. There's a little challenge you can take on the website, shanti.com, shaunti.com. Be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. It's 31 minutes after the hour, and I think we're all in the studio here committed to being extra kind, at least the rest of the day. Rebecca's looking at me like, yeah, I'm going to go for it.
We got to set goals.
You got to set goals. Got to set goals. You know, when you're trying to be kind to everyone and you put yourself in other people's shoes, sometimes the most difficult shoes to step into would be someone that you think, I think this person has mental illness, and you don't know if they're troubled or depressed or whatever, but maybe there's mental illness involved, and you absolutely need to be kind, of course, but it can be difficult to understand. There's certain stigmas around that. My guest on our studio line is Amy Simpson. She's an author and speaker and leadership coach. She's written several books. The one I'd like to chat with her about today is called Troubled Minds: Mental Illness and the Church's Mission. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
You know, I promise that I see more and more people in my everyday life that I go, I think that person's got some mental illness, where maybe I'm just becoming more aware, or maybe I'm just a little bit wiser, or what? What do you think?
Yeah, well, it's probably, my guess is it's both of those things.
Okay.
But it may also be that mental illness is actually on the rise in our society. So it actually is becoming more common for people to experience mental health problems. And, you know, part of that is that we're getting better at diagnosing these things, and part of it is that, in my, you know, my theory is that our society is becoming more demanding, you know, in terms of what it takes for us to fulfill the obligations that are put before us, whether it's our stress levels, you know, our levels of anxiety, the number of demanding messages that we're exposed to on a daily basis, the sense of disconnection that we feel with one another, even while we're, you know, virtually connected. All of those things have an impact on the way, you know, the level at which people are able to fulfill all the demands of life.
Mm-hmm. Are some of the stigmas around mental illnesses, are they diminishing?
I think we are seeing some movement there, that stigma is decreasing somewhat, and I think that's happening in our broader culture and to some degree within the church as well. But we have a long way to go on that. There's still a lot of misinformation out there about mental illness and a lot of misunderstanding about, you know, how we might best respond. And I think just a lot of fear still around this topic, you know, fear to talk about it, fear to do or say the wrong thing, or even fear of people who are affected by mental health problems and this sense of that, you know, this automatic assumption that they might be dangerous or that, you know, we need to be afraid of them in some way because we don't quite understand where they're coming from or what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Amy, has your family known some of this trauma from mental illness?
Absolutely. Yeah, my interest in this topic, my passion around it, and particularly how the church relates and responds to people with mental illness comes from my own family background and experience. I'm actually a pastor's kid. My dad was a pastor for 10 years while I was growing up. And I'm also the child of a parent with severe mental illness. My mom has schizophrenia. And so the combination of those two experiences, you know, obviously have driven me to the point where I have become, you know, an advocate for people and write frequently on this topic and speak on this topic because of my own family experience and because the more I talk about it, the more I write about it, the more other people's stories I hear as well. And our family, we've experienced so much of the negative impact that mental illness can have, not only on a person and on a family, but also on our relationships with the broader world. You know, the ways that people relate or don't relate to people who have mental illness, the ways that they pull away from those who are affected, it can be devastating.
Mm-hmm. Amy, if I'm not being too personal, could you give us an example of an interaction you would have with your mom, which would be sort of a manifestation of her schizophrenia and how you dealt with it?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of stories about that, and some of them are hard to talk about for me, obviously. Some of them are hard to explain to people who haven't been there.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one particular experience that I write about, that I wrote about in Troubled Minds and that I've talked about frequently in front of audiences, and that is, I think it's a good illustration of some of what families experience who are affected by serious mental illness. You know, when I was 15 years old, my mom was, being treated for schizophrenia, but she wasn't doing well this particular day. She picked me up after school for a dentist appointment, and I knew immediately, you know, she was not okay. But we made it safely to the dentist's office, and I went back for my appointment, and when I came back out, my mom was catatonic. She was immovable. Her whole body was tightly clenched. She was staring into space. She was obviously psychotic and not aware of reality. And, you know, I was a 15-year-old kid. I was, you know, as far as mental illness is concerned, I was a normal kid. You know, I was perfectly lucid. And yet there were a lot of other people in this waiting room, in this dentist's office. And as I tried to help my mom and kind of pull her out of that catatonic state, which sometimes worked, you know, I knew some things to try to try to help her come out of that state. I was not able to do that on that occasion. She, you know, remained in that completely non-responsive state. But as I was trying to work with her and trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to do now? How am I going to – what I wanted to do was to get her out of there. You know, this is a very public, very humiliating and frightening situation for me. There were all these other people who were in that waiting room who were staring at us and looking away and staying silent and not saying anything and you know, kind of refusing to get involved. And to some degree, I can't blame them for that. But to another degree, you know, these are suffering people in your midst. And, you know, the experience of not only having the interaction with my mom as she was psychotic, but also having that interaction in a public place and having people present and not helping was obviously traumatizing. You know, it was devastating, and is a good illustration actually of what happens a lot with people who walk through this kind of thing, either individually or in their family. You know, just not getting support, not getting help, not getting a response from others in this kind of situation because people are so, you know, put off or scared or uncertain what to do. And that's, you know, people experience that a lot, and my family certainly did.
Mm-hmm. Amy, I would love to try to use this as a teachable moment. If I was in the dentist's office that day and I was watching this happen with this 15-year-old girl and her mother, mm-hmm. What could I have done that would have been useful?
Yeah, I think, and this is a question that people, you're not asking it this way, but a question that people often ask in another way, and that is, what can we possibly do? You know, kind of people kind of throw up their hands and say, I don't know how to help. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. Well, we could have used a psychiatrist at that moment,
yes.
Right? But that wasn't the only thing we needed. That wasn't what I needed. You know, my mom needed a psychiatrist. I needed to know that I was not alone.
Mm.
I needed, you know, somebody to just be there with me or to help me do what I knew I needed to do, which ultimately was to call my dad for help.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of getting that support, you know, I was literally on my own in this group of people. So if somebody who didn't know what to do, you know, who has that script going through their head, I don't know how to help, I don't know, I don't understand this situation, I'm not qualified to, you know, administer any kind of help here. If they merely would have gotten up out of their chair, come over to me, maybe put their hand on my shoulder and said, how can I help? You know, or I'm sorry, it seems like you're having a hard time. Is there anything I can do to help? You know, just something to send that message that I wasn't alone, you know, that I had an advocate or that I had someone who was willing to help me as I, you know, maybe sit with my mom while I went to use the phone to call my dad for help or, you know, to talk with me, maybe to talk with her or hold her hand or, you know, that kind of thing. None of that is about fixing the problem, right? It's
mm-hmm.
about being there with people who are in it, which is, for the most part, that is what I ask churches to do. You know, it's to look past the ways that we are tempted to think we must fix the problem and to actually just be with the person,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, a completely different approach.
Yeah, I'm sure the thoughts that go through people's minds are, I don't know what to do. I don't want to make anything worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know why our brains go there.
Yeah, it's understandable. and yet, we know, I think we often think of mental illness as more unique than it really is. It is unique. It's, you know, it's a form of illness that attacks the brain, you know, or that originates in the brain, some kind of disorder in the brain, which is different from disorders of the heart or of the liver or
mm-hmm.
of the lung. But at the same time, it's not unique in the sense that what we're seeing here is human suffering. And if we saw somebody, you know, in front of us who maybe they just had an accident and they were bleeding. You know, we wouldn't probably sit by, and even if we didn't know how to administer, we hadn't been trained in first aid, we still probably would not sit by and watch it happen and just think, well, there's nothing I can do. Or, you know, if we saw someone in front of us who maybe, you know, they were obviously going through cancer treatment, you know, and they were, they looked like they needed help, you know, just physically kind of getting through the demands of what was in front of them, you know, likely we would try to help. Or somebody who's affected by old age or by a physical disability, you know, we in those moments, even though we don't know how to fix the problem, because most of us, I mean, nobody knows how to cure cancer, right? And most of us aren't qualified to administer chemotherapy and radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we know instinctively and accept the idea that a person who is going through those treatments doesn't need us to come and cure their cancer. They need us to be with them in it. And that's really the same thing with mental illness. You know, what people need from us is what we actually are qualified to give, and that is to draw near, to be with, you know, to give them the gift of our presence and help them, you know, direct them to professional help, you know, help them afford the medications that they need. You know, there are a lot of practical things we can do as well, but a lot of times it's just about doing our best to try to make sure people are not alone and know that they're not.
Oh, that's so wise, Amy. It's just so profound. So thank you for reminding all of us that people need us to be present in their lives, even if the situation that we're witnessing is not comfortable for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to take a little break. When I come back, I want to ask you about mental illness. And is it something that is static or is it always changing? And if it changes, who gets to decide what mental illness is? And what is it like when we talk to someone we care about that we think is dealing with mental illness? How do we be effective in communicating to them that we think they need professional help? That's all ahead with Amy Simpson. She's written a book called Troubled Minds, Mental Illness, and the Church's Mission. We'll take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Amy Simpson is my guest. She does it all. Author, speaker, editor, leadership coach. The book we're chatting about today, it's called Troubled Minds, Mental Illness and the Church's Mission. Amy, is mental illness, is it static? Is it always, are they always moving the goalposts? And who gets to decide what mental illness is?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I think it's first of all important to recognize that there is a spectrum here of mental health. And on any given day, any person could be, you know, their mental health can be compromised, at least on a temporary basis. You know, I wake up one morning and I'm just not feeling it. And maybe there are circumstances in my life that mean my mindset that day is harmful to me. You know, it's tearing me down. Maybe it's harming other people. But that's a temporary mindset. You know, it's a temporary circumstance. There are a couple of criteria that are generally important in diagnosing a mental health problem, an actual mental illness. One is that, you know, the person experiences the symptoms, the diagnostic criteria for that mental illness over an extended period of time. And I think the length of time differs depending on the type of illness we're talking about. But it's not like, oh, I've been feeling this way for a couple days or even a couple of weeks. It's, you know, over an extended period of time, this is an ongoing issue. And the other one is that there is a disturbance that is at the level that it actually interferes with a person's ability to function with the normal everyday demands of life. So there's an impairment test and there's a longevity test. And then the individual criteria, you know, will differ depending on the illness. And there is actually psychology is somewhat subjective, absolutely, but there is a manual. It's called the Diagnostical and Statistical Manual, the DSM. and it's what all mental health professionals use to diagnose. So there are established standards. It's not like, you know, somebody's just making stuff up. And these remain pretty static, actually. The DSM has been around for decades. It's updated every maybe 10 to 15 years. But those diagnostic criteria stay pretty static. What changes is, you know, the environment we live in. I talked at the beginning of the show about the demands of life, you know, are increasing in some ways. In many ways, our everyday lives have become more stressful. And as those things happen, or as we find ourselves having to adapt as humans to, you know, circumstances that we weren't made for. For example, you know, extremely traumatic events like wars or, you know, displacement, living in a refugee camp, you know, something like that. Those are circumstances that may produce or reveal a mental health problem that wouldn't have emerged without those circumstances. So, you know, as our conditions and our environment change, we can begin to see mental health problems emerge that maybe wouldn't have otherwise. But the diagnostic criteria themselves are well established and remain for the most part pretty static.
Mm-hmm. Is mental illness, is it kind of a slippery slope? Is it one of those things where it happens over time, or is it kind of an on and off switch, like it happens in the course of a week where you go, oh boy, there's been some big changes in this person that I know and love?
Yeah, it certainly can be either. And it you know, this is where we're talking about a very broad category of disorders. So we have everything. There are a lot of different types of mental health problems that fall under the umbrella of mental illness, you know. So we're talking about everything from maybe a depression that builds over time, you know, as someone is as their thoughts are destructive to them, as they're responding to their circumstances in a way that is actually harming them and deepens the pit, you know, so to speak, that they're falling into. That can happen over time, and it can be caused not only by our circumstances, but primarily by our response to our circumstances. And so it may happen gradually. On the other hand, you may have someone who seems to become very depressed quite suddenly. And that might be because it's actually caused by a biological issue rather than a, you know, a response to their circumstances. Maybe there's a medical health issue that's causing their brain to function differently. You know, so, or, you know, a good example is postpartum depression, which can be both circumstantial and biological, you know, a response to the hormonal changes that happen for a woman after giving birth. And obviously that can have a very sudden onset because that event of giving birth and all the changes that are happening in medically and biologically can produce that very suddenly. So, you know, it really depends. And then, you know, at another point on the spectrum, we're talking about people who have illnesses like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder who can begin to develop those symptoms very suddenly or kind of gradually. And that depends partly on the person's circumstances, you know, their environment, and what kind of causes that illness, that genetic predisposition to actually emerge into an illness. So it really can be both, and it's hard to say, you know, that this is what mental illness looks like because it can wear so many different faces and actually be a pretty individual experience in terms of its expression. But I just encourage people to pay attention. You know, if somebody you love, they seem like they're not themselves for an extended period of time, or you see some, you know, alarming behaviors or evidence that the person is not thinking clearly, those are important things to pay attention to. And mental illness can actually be degenerative, some forms of mental illness. So early intervention is extremely important because over time, with some forms of mental disorders, they actually degenerate the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And can actually become much worse if they're not treated on a timely basis.
Amy, here's more of a theological question, maybe. Would idols of your heart turn into mental illness?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think anything that causes that can distort our thinking
mm-hmm.
certainly can produce a mental illness, although that's absolutely not, you know, all happening all the time. You know, in fact, much of the time, most of the time, mental illness is pretty complex. So you have, again, you have a spectrum of disorders where a disorder like schizophrenia is very genetic, it's very biological. You know, there's something happening biologically in the brain that produces that disorder. You can't cause yourself to have schizophrenia, you know, unless you do something to alter your brain chemistry. For example, like, so there are things like smoking marijuana can produce schizophrenia, but you have to have that genetic predisposition. On the other hand, you know, depression and anxiety disorders can have multiple causes, and they can be caused through our, you know, the way, the patterns of thinking, again, how we respond to our circumstances, but they can also be caused by biological issues as well, and many times it's both. You know, it's not really one or the other. It's complex, and we need to, you know, mental health professionals will try to kind of treat both causes or all of the causes that they become aware of. So, you know, somebody might be prescribed, for example, an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety medication, but also they are encouraged to do therapy, you know, to attend counseling and to change their patterns of thinking in addition to maybe taking a medication that's going to help pull them out of that state so that they can make better choices. They can keep themselves safe. You know, they can think more clearly. So often it's really both.
We just have like 2 minutes left, Amy. So I'm going to curious as to your feelings about how the church is doing. Are they responding in a Christ-like way? Are we trying to be wiser with how we deal with people suffering from mental illnesses, or are we still stuck in a bad pattern?
I'm going to say both, actually. I think we are making progress here, and actually this book, Troubled Minds, I wrote it, you know, it came out 5.5 years ago, and I've seen a shift, a pretty significant shift even just in that time in terms of many churches' awareness of mental illness, the level at which we're educated about it and responding to it. At the same time, you know, there are plenty of places in the church where ignorance kind of reigns here, and where we tend to respond to people in really counterproductive ways. So I'm hopeful there's positive progress happening, and yet we still have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Is your dear mother still with us?
She is.
Terrific.
Yes. My mom is still with us, and she's still battling her illness, and we're doing our best to, you know, to help her in that fight.
Well, God bless her, and thank you, Amy, for your devotion to her and your concern to share your experience through your book with others and give them hope as well, and it's just to increase the understanding. I certainly appreciate everything you shared on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
The opportunity to talk with you.
Oh, of course. Amy Simpson has been my guest. Her book is Troubled Minds, Mental Illness and the Church's Mission. It's, you know, I'm thinking about just sometimes there's people who can be an enthusiast about something, and I go, when does it cross into mental illness? I mean, you know, like if you collect something and you go, at a certain point you're an enthusiast, and then at a certain point you go, that ain't right. That's like, that could be mental illness. But then who gets to diagnose that? And how do you confront someone that is maybe carried away? And I was wondering if that's kind of an idol of the heart, where you have something that you have so much into that it becomes this big thing, and it becomes too big, and then you're down a mental illness road. I don't know. It's a complicated subject, and I am not the guy to be talking to about this. So anyway, Amy Simpson was a wonderful guest, and I sure appreciated her coming onto the show. We're going to take a little break, and then hour two is just ahead. Thanks for listening to Afternoons with me, Bill Arnold. Be right back. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.